But I wanted to kind of do some highlights because there's a lot of confusion about what has been cut and what hasn't. And there's been so much focus on the clinic that all the rest is getting a little bit lost, I'm concerned. So the way this is organized, the first two pages are about the direct cuts to healthcare. And by healthcare, I mean things like hospitals, MSP, PharmaCare, the kind of mainstream healthcare-y stuff. It includes physiotherapy and all, you know, naturopathy. But there's been huge cuts to social services and other things that clearly directly affect people's health. So that's the next three pages of depressing news. In terms of cuts to healthcare, there's sort of four basic sections on a provincial level and then some cuts that have happened on a regional level that each health region throughout the province is making decisions on. So in my region, which isn't here, there's recently been decisions to cut addiction residential treatment program, the only one on the island. That's not happened here because that's a regional level. But on a provincial level, what's happened is the amount of funding increase for health is not enough to keep up with the increased costs that happen every year just due to inflation and the contracts that workers had worked out. So even though no money has been cut from health, the money is not enough to sustain healthcare. So what that means is that healthcare has been cut, effectively. And so far, that's taken a range of things that have happened. PharmaCare has been cut. Some of the medications have been delisted. There's also, you have to pay increased premiums now when you go and get medication. It's all listed in detail, so I'm not going to go over it. I just really want to touch on the highlights. MSP, some of the big changes include increased MSP premiums. There's also been greatly reduced coverage for different kinds of things that MSP used to cover, things like massage, physiotherapy. There's been big changes to the health benefits that were available for people who were on welfare, and also people who weren't on welfare, but who had incomes that were so low that they couldn't afford necessary health care. And that's how many women got electrolysis. Many trans women got electrolysis through that little piece, whether or not they were on welfare. That's been removed. So you no longer have access to emergency health needs. You only have access to emergency nutrition, and it's a much more limited category. There's also huge changes, of course, in welfare that affect people's health around people getting the amounts of their checks cut. That's a little bit later, because it's not a cut to healthcare per se. So what this has all meant, and then there's a whole other category, and one of the big things that's happened is that health regions are getting less money. So there's this downshifting of responsibility for health services from the province to health regions, but fewer and fewer resources, and big changes in how the health regions are structured too. So locally, I know there's been some big cuts to the health region, and there are probably people here who could speak on this much better than I could. But one of the changes that happened was there were cuts to Vancouver General Hospital, and they in turn cut the psychiatry budget, and they in turn cut the gender clinic funding so substantially that the clinic can't continue to operate. And I'll sort of treat the clinic a little bit separately further on because I'm sure people have questions about what is happening and not happening. And again, there's people here, not me, who could probably speak more accurately to that. So that's the bad news about healthcare. I circulated a draft of this and someone said, oh, this is really bad. Isn't there any good news? And well, quite frankly, no. But there has been some really good legal developments for trans people over the last couple years, especially relating to human rights. And unfortunately, the Human Rights Commission is on the chopping block. They've already been cut hugely in terms of their funding, and there is proposed legislation that will come up in October to actually get rid of them altogether. There'll still be a tribunal, but no commission. And it's the commission that has funded many of our education efforts and taken a really strong stance in support of trans people's legal rights. So that's the good news, is we got some legal rights. Sort of, kind of, not in writing on the law, but in terms of the tribunal's position. Okay, now the bad news. So there are many, many cuts that will make the status of the health of our communities worse than it already is, and it's already fairly abysmal. I've been doing a project unrelated to this, but on trans health, and so looking at health status across North America, and it's pretty bad. It's even worse than I thought it would be. Violence in relationships, over 50%. People experiencing hate crimes, over 60%. People having difficulty accessing the basics of healthcare, things like regular gynecological checkups, is appalling. So we still don't know a lot about what's happening here in terms of the status of our communities, but what we do know is not very good. So just to make things worse, huge cuts to social assistance and huge changes, particularly in how people with disabilities get funded, or not, as the case may be. Huge restrictions in who gets to qualify for welfare, how long you get to be on welfare. Huge penalties if you commit what they call fraud, if you do anything to supplement your income and you don't declare it. So, and huge cuts to rates as well, especially for single parents. There have been housing cuts, changes to employment that will reduce workers' rights and wages and number of jobs in the province. Extreme legal changes around legal aid, all sorts of legal services, and an end to universal childcare, end of tuition freeze. It just kind of goes on and on. So I just wanted to give you a sense that things are indeed fairly grim. And if you have any questions about specific cuts, you're welcome to ask them, and I'll either know them or someone else will, hopefully. But I just really like to encourage, if you don't know, say that you don't know. Because one of the things I've seen happen over the last few months is there's been no news and people are just kind of speculating and it gets bigger and bigger and scarier. And one of the things that I thought this was a really great opportunity to do is make sure accurate information is getting out there. So are there any questions other than the clinic about what programs still exist, what cuts have been made? I think this is the end of the info.
Okay.
All right. Your last name is Robertson, right?
Yes, I'm Gail Robertson. I'm the president of the Zenith Foundation.
Okay. So, I mean, here in the room, there seems to be a lot of questions about what's going to happen to people's medical records at the gender clinic. Are they going to stay at the clinic? Will they become part of the VGH archives? Will they go to your family physician? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't think I know the answer completely, but what I think is going to happen is that certainly record copies of your files will be sent to your general practitioner. In many cases, that's already being done because, for example, let's say you had a diagnosis 3 years ago and that a copy of that would be put in your file at the clinic, and certainly a copy is at least would be sent to your family physician. So in that sense, a copy, I would think, of many things that are at the clinic would also be in your family physician's files. As far as the files at the clinic, it's my understanding that they're kept separate from the general medical files. Say you went to the Vancouver General Hospital with a broken leg. Anyone looking at those files around that issue would not see anything related to being a member of the patient in the gender clinic, because I guess it's not relevant, and they try to separate that out. When the clinic closes down, it's my understanding that all the files will be put away for storage, and but I don't know what will happen. I would guess is that they would be somehow kept separate from any of the more general medical files that you have at the clinic. I mean, at the Vancouver General Hospital.
So it's kind of like your psychiatry file and your medical file are not the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's my understanding. I think they're sort of trying to respect the privacy there. But obviously it can be a problem because, I mean, if you went into the VGH, let's say you've just had gender reassignment surgery and you are having problems around that, then obviously that kind of information is going to be available to who might be looking at the doctor who's looking after you at the VGH in emergency. So it becomes a real problem in that sense. But I think for most situations, they try to keep them separate. And I don't want to go on record as saying this is the truth. I think this is my impression at the moment.
Do you know, I mean, you just brought up an example of where having your gender clinic records as part of your regular medical history would be beneficial. Do you know if this is something that you can make a choice to do?
No, I don't think so. If a letter is sent to the clinic to your family physician, it will go into your family physician's files along with all of your other medical history. I doubt very much that any general practitioner would want to really separate these out, because as a general rule, only he or she is going to look at them, and there would be no real point in separating them out. I suppose if for some reason you wanted You could discuss with your family physician. Let's say you had to have some information sent to someone else, specialist, or make up an example, or you know, you've got internal problems that have got nothing to do with gender or sexual issues, then maybe you could request that those files not be sent, because I don't think they, in general, people are going to want to look at your whole file, because obviously it's really, really thick. But they are, they will tend to be mixed in. I know that mine are. They're just sort of, the folder is over many years, has got all sorts of information in it. It must be 2 or 3 inches thick, and it's all jumbled up. It, well, it's not jumbled up. It's really basically chronological.
Mm-hmm. So do you know if people want to get a hold of their medical file to see what's in it? How do you do that?
You can go to your family doctor. Then, as a matter of fact, I've done that in the past, and I, you know, I've asked, and I was there a little while ago to see my own family doctor, and I asked, with because the clinic was closing down, if I could look at what my medical files were in regards to that part, and there was no problem. They, in fact, they gave me copies of my files that were sent to them from the clinic. So I don't think there's generally any problem, but you're obviously not going to be able to remove things from your file, or but you could if you wanted to add things to your file. So, for example, if you wanted to add your own perspective into your medical file, you could add it to the existing file.
And do you have an email address or anything that people can email you at if they have more questions about this?
Yes, they could email me care of the Zenith Foundation. I'd have to look up the Zenith Foundation's. Let's see, it's right here, so let me have a look. And if you want to email me, you can do it to Gail Roberts. I'm currently the president of Zenith, and if you don't know this, Zenith is an organization that really is an advocacy group for male to female transsexuals. Anyway, the email address is Zenith Foundation, which of course would be all one word, @hotmail.com. So you could get hold of me through that, Gail Roberts, Zenith Foundation, @hotmail.com.
Great. Thanks a lot. Anyhow, so I'm wondering if maybe for the benefit of the people who weren't at this session today and don't have the handout, if we can just kind of go over, you know, what have the government cutbacks been and how do they affect trans folks? So, for example, with PharmaCare and MSP, you know, what's gone on in the last year that people should be aware of?
Well, I think any of the information produced by the many groups that are fighting the cuts will be really useful in terms of thinking about trans people, because we share a lot of the same concerns. So things like cuts to welfare, that doesn't only affect the trans community, but it affects a lot of trans people. And when I was compiling the list, this hideous 5-page list of cuts, I was using websites, QP, the BC Federation of Labor. There are many organizations that are compiling really good, solid information. So rather than sort of listing them all specifically, maybe if I just touch on the ones that affect mostly trans people and not so much of the general community. So I think the really obvious ones are the cuts to healthcare, because there have been specific cuts that hurt trans people quite seriously. One of them is the delisting of testosterone as a medication covered by PharmaCare. And what that means is that FTMs, female to males, who are taking testosterone as part of gender transition, if they were getting coverage for their prescription before, they now have to go through an extra bureaucratic series of processes to get what's called special authority. And approval of that is at the government's discretion. So it's meaning that some people have coverage and some people don't. And that affects people who are poor, because people who aren't poor generally either have enough money to pay for their own prescription or weren't getting PharmaCare coverage anyway. So that's one that I know has really hit the FTM community hard. The cuts to the gender clinic, although people have really mixed feelings about the clinic, have meant a great uncertainty as to how people will access transition services. And because the gender clinic was the only gatekeeper for MSP funding for sex reassignment surgery, with the clinic gone, it's just not clear how you will now get that funding, what will happen to that funding.
Mm-hmm. So what are the cuts to the gender clinic? I mean, the last time we spoke to Miriam on the program, it was still unclear exactly what was going to happen to the gender clinic. So where is that at?
Well, there's a lot of questions still, and communication has, quite frankly, been lousy. So it's never really clear whether the gender clinic doesn't know what's happening or whether they know but just aren't saying. What they have said at this point is that so many of their administrative and practitioner positions have been cut that they can't continue to operate as a clinic. So while three psychiatrists will remain, they all work part-time and share the equivalent of one full-time position. And that's simply not enough to do what they used to do, which was go through a long, drawn-out process of assessing people for both their meeting the criteria set by MSP for sex reassignment surgery, and also just trying to assess people's need for other services. Whether or not they did a good job of that is another issue, but they can't provide those kinds of assessments at all now. So what they're talking about is trying to finish off with the patients they already have by sending letters of recommendation to those patients' GPs, and possibly making recommendations around surgery for patients who they've been seeing for a long time and they feel comfortable doing that. They're not taking any new referrals at the moment, and if you became a patient after January 1st, they have just sent you back to your GP. So at the moment, there's really not many services being offered through the clinic. They're in the process of closing down, essentially.
And what about, I mean, I know you said you wanted to leave most of the discussions of general service cuts to people to check on various websites where the information is more succinct, but certainly it came up in the meeting that there are cuts to welfare and disability benefits that seem to have quite direct impacts on the trans community. So I'm wondering if you might be able to elaborate on that a little bit, specifically with regards to disability.
Sure. One of the things that is a huge issue for trans people is poverty and unemployment. And one of the reasons for that is discrimination in employment, which is one of the topics that came up at the meeting, that people have difficulty finding and keeping work because employers do discriminate against trans people. There are also many other reasons why there's quite widespread poverty in the trans community, and one of those reasons is that many trans people have disabilities that prevent them from working. And the way this province deals with people with disabilities is to keep them poor. So the changes to welfare have profoundly impacted our communities because there are so many people who rely on social assistance for their basic needs, food, shelter. And the cuts have been in sort of three dimensions. One is huge changes in who is eligible for particular kinds of assistance. So the eligibility criteria for Disability 2 has changed, for example. Disability 1 no longer exists. People who are on Disability 1 have, for the most part, been moved on to the regular rates of welfare, which are quite a bit lower than disability benefits. And you also lose the health benefits that came along with the status of having disability. Disability 2 hasn't changed as much in terms of the dollar figures that people have access to, but the extended health benefits available to people on Disability 2 have changed, and one of the things that's been cut was the access to emergency life-threatening health needs. There used to be a provision in Schedule C that enabled people who had those needs to apply for coverage for pretty much anything through their worker. And in many cases, trans people were applying to get coverage for electrolysis, arguing that it was an emergency life-threatening health need, and were successful in appeals. And that's now gone completely, so people have no access to that coverage. The third way that it's been impacted is, of course, the direct cuts to people's dollar figures for anyone who's receiving regular assistance, and particularly for single parents and seniors who have had their rates cut even more than the general single population. Their welfare has announced further cuts will be made to the shelter portion as well, so as of July 1st, people started receiving even less money.
Mm-hmm. So what have the trans groups in British Columbia been doing up to this point to try and clarify, you know, what's going to happen from here, and where are you at this point?
I think it would be a mistake to give the impression that there is some kind of universal response. I think lots of people have been fighting poverty for lots of years. Certainly trans sex workers have been fighting for their rights for many, many years, and their efforts have tended to be completely excluded from what's considered trans activism. I think that in terms of sort of the formal groups that exist, which tend to be a little bit more mainstream, there have been some efforts to lobby the clinic directly, to work with our communities to come up with some kind of positive solution for a transition plan. They've refused to do that. So we have also lobbied Vancouver General Hospital, which funded the clinic, and the clinic was part of the hospital. and requested that they meet with us to, again, not necessarily restore funding to the clinic, but to talk about what our health needs are and how to meet them. And they have responded by indicating they're willing to meet with us, and that will be happening this week. They'll be meeting with us along with a person from the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority to explain to us what their plan is for protecting the services that were cut and coming up with alternative plans for making sure people can still get access to healthcare.
Now, you said that, well, I mean, I guess one of the big questions that is up in the air right now is, without the clinic, how are people going to get referrals for surgery and treatment? Because up until now, the clinic was always basically the only person that MSP would listen to, or the only body that MSP would listen to. You made some comments in the meeting about recommendations that you're making. I'm wondering if maybe you can elaborate on those a bit.
Sure. We're taking our direction from what people in other provinces have done, because there have never been clinics in every province. There, until recently, was one in Quebec, one in Toronto, and one here. And so we've been looking to Alberta and Saskatchewan, PEI, and some of the other provinces to see, what are trans people doing there? If you don't have a clinic, how can you get the healthcare you need? And there are some great strategies that people have used. One is to develop a network of practitioners who understand our community's health concerns, have expertise on those issues, and are willing to work with us. And I think that's the direction we will likely go in here, that if the clinic no longer exists as the gatekeeper, it's actually tremendously exciting from my perspective, because it opens up being able to choose who your practitioner is and being able to see someone close to home instead of having to come to Vancouver for every single service. So I think if that can happen, if there is support for that to happen on both an administrative, sort of bureaucratic level, and if MSP is willing to change its policies to follow what's worked quite successfully in Alberta, for example, we could have a really workable system, you know? Mm-hmm. What's needed is for practitioners in the community to make themselves known as people who have expertise on these issues and feel qualified and competent and willing to work with us.
Mm-hmm. So what is the Alberta model?
They follow the Harry Benjamin standards, HBIGDA, that's the acronym for the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, blah, blah, blah. They're an international group, and they're made up of health professionals and trans people and academics and others who have sort of interest in trans health. And they create sort of international standards of practice. They started because they were worried that essentially, doctors who weren't really trained to be practicing transgender medicine were doing it anyway, and with some pretty grave consequences, botched surgeries and lots of distress from people who weren't being assessed properly. And our community is really mixed about those standards. Some people feel that they create unnecessary barriers to getting needed health care. Some people feel that they provide sort of a good standardized baseline so that practitioners aren't, well, practicing quackery, frankly. And you know, however you're, whatever you feel about them, they are certainly more flexible and more realistic than the standards that have been used by MSP here to date. They are the standards that are followed in Alberta, and they include, you know, recommendations from two mental health professionals, whereas MSP here requires that the assessments be by psychiatrists, so that's much more limited. They also require that you spend less time cross-living before getting approval for surgery and hormones. All of the fine details of that will need to be worked out by MSP, but clearly Alberta has had it in place for quite some time. It's working for them, both in terms of trans people getting the care they need, and on a financial level, it's working for the government. So I'm really hopeful that MSP will see the wisdom of adopting that system as one that is tried and tested and works.
So what were your feelings coming out of the meeting today about what the community wants from its leadership in terms of moving forward and strategies to address issues in the future, and what were some of the concrete things that came out of today?
First of all, I hate meetings, so if you ask me what my impression was of today, I hated it. It was terrible. I have to say that it's really interesting, this whole question of leadership. You know, who is a leader and who's going to decide what strategies we take? I think the trans community, like every other marginalized community, suffers from the fact that the people who show up are often the most opinionated people, but not necessarily the people who are most representative of the diversity of our communities. And this meeting was no exception. I was really excited that so many people came and that so many people did speak about what they wanted to see. And I think there's lots of disagreement within our community, and I think that's fine and that's normal. Clearly, people are very concerned about poverty. Clearly, people are very concerned about access to healthcare, and those two are related. So I think that a quite a bit of energy is going to go towards trying to protect access to transition services. I think also that there are a number of people who are dissatisfied with that as the only strategy and want to pursue some broader issues around health needs more generally, which includes things like housing and food and access to some of the basics, not just transition-related care. And I think really, if you're looking at the trans community rather than the transsexual community, transition issues are not necessarily on the forefront of everyone's mind. And even within the transsexual community, if you have much more pressing and urgent needs, transition-related care may just not be where it's at. Mm-hmm.
So what's going to happen after today? You're having a meeting on Wednesday with the Vancouver General Hospital folks and the Coastal Health Authority folks, and then is there another meeting after that of the group that met today?
Well, the meeting today was sponsored by Trans Alliance, which is a provincial umbrella group. My guess, judging by how people were sort of planning near the end, is that more meetings may be on a regional basis rather than attempting to do a provincial meeting. I think that people are broke and tired and just don't have the stamina to keep coming to Vancouver for some kind of provincial focus. I think with the shifting of health responsibilities from the province to the health regions, that makes a lot of sense. These battles are going to be fought more and more on a regional level. And we'll keep talking with each other across regions to see what provincial strategies we can put in place and when we need to lobby the Liberal provincial government. But I think part of it is that a lot of us are kind of scared of the Liberal provincial government and see the health regions as potentially a little bit more friendly.
Cool. Thank you.